Korea has warned that an unwelcome Christmas gift could be coming soon. Experts say that should not be a surprise to anyone.
If they didn't do anything, I think it would be more surprising than if they did something. But the question is what the something is really unclear.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today on The World, Russian and Syrian jets are bombing civilians in northern Syria. Many people are being displaced.
The concern is that under pressure and to go back into areas that they're not from could in essence amount to a degree of demographic or almost ethnic reengineering of this part of Syria.
And the longest railway bridge in Europe opens up, connecting Russia to Russian-occupied Crimea.
Добрый день, дорогие друзья. У нас сегодня...
Vladimir Putin is celebrating. Many others are not. Those stories and more today on The World. It was, quote, a snap decision. That's part of what we heard today from the public prosecutor's office in Saudi Arabia, referring to the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in October of 2018. The CIA, you might remember, concluded something very different last year. It said the murder of Khashoggi, who is also a U.S. permanent resident, was ordered by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi prosecutor also announced today that five men are being sentenced to death in connection with the killing. Three more were sentenced to a total of 24 years in prison. And two others, both senior officials close to the Saudi crown prince, were cleared of any wrongdoing.
I do not believe for one second that the presence of a forensic doctor was an accident.
That's Agnes Callamard, the special rapporteur with United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Callamard says that while one group of Saudi hitmen were found guilty and sentenced to death, the masterminds of Khashoggi's murder get to walk free.
The execution of Mr. Khashoggi was a state execution. It is not, as they try to pretend, a rogue operation or a mistake. It's a state killing. And as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable.
Along with the CIA, officials from other Western nations have said they believe that Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, ordered the killing. Sarah Lee Whitson is a Middle East expert at Human Rights Watch in New York. As none of the defendants' names were released to the public, I asked Whitson what we know about the suspects who were released.
What we understand is that among the 11 who were charged, the two highest level people in that batch were General Asiri, who was the deputy head of intelligence. And, you know, I would say the person they threw out there as the highest level Saudi intelligence official to charge them, to give the appearance that they were not just going after the lowest level operatives. He was acquitted. The other person is the consul general in Istanbul, Saud al-Qahtani, who was believed by U.S. intelligence, of course, to be, along with MBS, the masterminds of this entire operation, and according to Turkish intelligence reports, actually Skyped in and communicated with Jamal during the kidnapping and eventual killing of Jamal, was never, in fact, even charged.
How is the Saudi government explaining the differences between their verdict and the findings of the U.N. investigation?
Well, the Saudi prosecutor has said that the plan was to kidnap Jamal and bring him back to Saudi Arabia, but that at the spur of the moment, the operations team instead decided to kill Jamal and to dispose of his body. We still, of course, have no indication what they actually did with the body or where the body is. This, of course, flies against the face of the facts in that they had an autopsy expert and an expert in dismembering bodies. Apparently, they had a bone saw on hand with them. According to the recordings reviewed by Agnes Callamard, between the time that Jamal was actually threatened by this hit team in Istanbul at the consulate and the time when his dismemberment commenced was about 6 minutes. So really not enough time to, at the spur of the moment, decide to kill him, run out, buy a bone saw, and come back to the consulate.
So these verdicts come just days before the intelligence community hands Congress its own report about the killing of Khashoggi and whether Mohammed bin Salman was involved. What do you make of the timing?
I think the timing smacks of something more than a coincidence. We have this verdict that's coming out. I expect that at minimum, the report to Congress will include citations of this verdict for whatever conclusion they reach and may just give the administration the out it needs from having to implicate MBS and even Qahtani by relying on this Saudi verdict.
Well, Agnes Callamard said the verdict is a mockery of justice. The CIA concluded last year the orders for the killing of Khashoggi came directly from MBS. So how do you think the White House should be reacting to the announcement of these death sentences?
Well, you know, any fair observation of this trial would clearly see that it is just a part of the pattern of the Saudi government's efforts to lie and conceal what they actually did and what they actually organized. The trial was carried out with absolute secrecy, with zero transparency, with zero indication of the evidence presented or reviewed. And so it's not a serious trial, and the administration certainly knows that. And they should know and be able to say that, but I doubt that they will.
Sarah Lee Whitson, head of the Middle East and North Africa Division at Human Rights Watch. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
For about a week now, Russian and Syrian planes have stepped up their bombing attacks in and around the city of Idlib in northwest Syria. Reports of civilian deaths and casualties have followed. Residents are fleeing to safer areas in the north. But as the World Shirin Jafari reports, people in those other parts of the country are facing struggles of their own.
Until a few days ago, Muhammad al-Kassoum spent most of his days at a school in northwest Syria.
I teach kids from 6 years to 9 years old.
The 29-year-old English teacher has lived in Idlib all his life. He loved the school and the kids. He says through the years of war, he kept on teaching. Until a few days ago, when bombs started to fall. The kids stayed home, and the school closed down. Mohammed says now he spends most of his days in the basement of his home, along with two of his friends. They're hiding from the airstrikes.
They start at the morning at 9 o'clock.
The line wasn't good when we talked. He says the bombings start at 9 in the morning, and they go on until midnight.
We listen to some voices, so we know this warplane.
He says we listen to the sound of the planes. It's a game they play to distract themselves. He says by now they've learned the difference between a Russian jet and a Syrian one.
I just wait till the planes finish, then we go out.
They stay in the basement until the bombing stops. Then they go out to assess the damage. And often what they witness is horrific. Scenes similar to this one. Civilians, including kids, trapped under rubble. Since last week, Russian and Syrian forces have intensified their attacks on Idlib in northwest Syria. Idlib is the last province held by rebels. The Syrian government claims its goal is to clear the area of terrorists. Fadl Abdelghani heads the Syrian Network for Human Rights, an opposition group that documents the war in Syria.
The Russian and their regime is targeting hospitals, schools, civilians, neighborhoods, and at least 70,000 have been displaced past couple of days.
He says Idlib residents are fleeing in droves. They're heading north to anywhere they can find shelter. What makes matters even worse, Abdelghani says, is that most aid organizations have left.
There is no real aid organization working for several reasons, but mainly because those area is controlled by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is organized as a terrorist group.
A UN Security Council resolution allows some aid to get in, but that resolution expires in January. Last week, the UN Security Council met to renew it. China and Russia both vetoed the measure. And it's not like the overall situation north of Idlib is much better.
Hello? Yeah, I can. Yeah, I hear you.
I call up Badrkhan Ahmed, a young Syrian journalist who lives near the border with Turkey. He tells me since October, when Turkish forces advanced into Syria, thousands of people have left their homes. Many fled to Iraq, and the ones who couldn't are struggling.
They are suffering now, living in the schools, in the classrooms, you know. They need blankets, they need mattresses, they need heaters for them, because now the weather here in winter is really cold.
Badrkhan says Syrians are exhausted by war. There are now so many factions fighting each other, it's hard to keep up. Fadil Abdulghani of the Syrian Network for Human Rights says, yet again, the world is standing by as bombs fall on civilians.
The problem is mainly with the failure from the Western country toward what's going on in Syria. These crimes against humanity.
Abdulghani visited the U.S. in September. He met with American officials and discussed the situation in Syria. But he says he didn't get very far.
I have this feeling there is no much care about what's going on to those civilians, and there is no political will.
President Trump has made it clear he doesn't want to send more troops into Syria. He's repeatedly said he wants to end U.S.'s involvement in endless wars. But the fighting continues. I ask Muhammad Al-Kassoum, the English teacher, how much longer he think he'll stay in Idlib.
I stayed here because of my health. I have to protect it.
He says he'll stay in the city as long as he can. He has to protect his house from looters.
I have to save it from the thieves too. Not only from the bombing, from the thieves.
Not only the bombings, but the thieves too, he says. Mohammed doesn't have any kids of his own, but he's been taking care of 6 orphans whose parents died in the war.
They are just 2 and 3 years old, and 2 of them are 6 years old.
Since this latest round of bombings started, he sent them away to Aleppo, another Syrian city in the north. He says he doesn't know when or if he'll be able to join them. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Turkey has its own plans for northern Syria, and those plans became a little more clear last week. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan unveiled a detailed $26 million proposal for a 20-mile stretch of land that Turkey seized from Kurdish forces earlier this year.
What they intend to do at this stage is to establish new areas and villages, establishing new buildings, establishing infrastructure, almost like a giant construction project.
Hardin Lang is with the Washington-based NGO Refugees International. He says Turkey wants to resettle up to 1 million Syrian refugees currently living in Turkey.
The vast majority of whom are not from this area.
They're from other parts of Syria, like Aleppo and Idlib. To date, very few Syrian refugees have returned to Syria. Lang says Turkey's resettlement plan is problematic.
The concern is that under pressure and to go back into areas that they're not from could in essence amount to a degree of demographic or almost ethnic reengineering of this part of Syria.
So what are the consequences of ethnically reengineering a whole area of a country?
To begin with, it's a huge violation of just humanitarian principles, and it's a precedent that we can't imagine wanting to see set in this way. But in addition, it's hard to imagine that those areas would ever be stable, given the kind of friction that would develop between the populations who are in essence being pushed back into these areas and those who had historically resided there for, you know, decades if not centuries.
Tens of thousands of Kurds, for example, have been displaced. Lang says Turkey could end up permanently altering the fabric of society along its border with Syria, and it's still unclear how the area would be governed.
This does raise a big question. You know, if President Erdogan claims that he wants Western donors to pay for a $26 billion project to resettle refugees in this part of the country, and there's no buy-in from any of the potential authorities who might be governing that area, the viability of that plan makes very little sense.
Lang says Turkey's government wants to expand its authority by pushing out Kurdish forces from the border area. Turkey has also been host to some of the largest numbers of refugees in the world, but the economy there is struggling, Lang says, and more the Turkish government is putting pressure on Syrian refugees to leave. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is doubling down on his government's new citizenship law. It creates a religious test for migrants seeking to become Indian citizens, but specifically leaves out Muslims, who make up about 15% of India's population. The law has sparked nationwide protests.
जो हिंदुस्तान की मिट्टी के मुसलमान हैं, जिनके पुरखे.
Speaking at a rally on Sunday, Modi said that Muslims who were born on Indian soil, whose ancestors are the children of Mother India, they had nothing to fear from the law. He went on to say that his opponents were spreading white lies. The protests have cut across religious lines, with many calling the legislation an assault on India's foundation as a secular nation. Along with the new law, Modi has promised to implement a national register of citizens. Soumya Shankar is a reporting fellow with the Ground Truth Project. Over the summer, she spent time in Assam in northeast India. It's one of the country's poorest states. Authorities there were already at work on a register of citizens, and the list they were compiling called into question the status of some 40 million people, most of them Muslims. Soumya spoke with one Muslim farmer who's struggling to prove he's an Indian citizen.
Marjat Ali is a 68-year-old farmer who ekes out a meager living in a little village of Assam. His citizenship was first questioned in 2015 when he presented his family's land documents from 1968 and 69. He also showed his voter ID cards as proof of being Indian. Local officials said the handwritten land documents will not work, so the family got online land documents. They reapplied. They received four notices for four hearings. They had to travel hundreds of miles on foot and on carts pulled by oxen. And even when they got to the hearing, officials told him there was no record linking him to his ancestors, not even to his own father. To an outside eye, the linkages were quite clear. Around the same time, Marjat Ali's older brother showed the same documents, and yet his entire family got their names included in the National Register of Citizens, or the NRC. There is no clear rhyme or reason for this. It is random, and it mostly boils down to lack of bureaucratic efficiency. Yet again, there was a fresh rejection list released, and many names were arbitrarily cut, including Marjat Ali's brothers. And the reason given? Linkage not available. Marjat Ali is severely depressed. Thoughts of suicide run through his mind, worrying his family and friends all the time. Since the beginning of the citizenship project in the state of Assam, more than 50 people have killed themselves. Worrying, anxious.
If my name doesn't appear, even with all these original documents, I'm forced to consider ending my life. Living is not an option like this. I will die if they say I'm not Indian. I am an Assamese. I am an Indian. I have prayed to Allah for my name to appear today in the National Register of Citizens. And if it does, I'll feed all the students at the madrasa where my younger son studies.
Ali walks alongside his paddy fields.
This ordeal is even worse than the 1983 riots.
During the 1983 riots, over 2,000 Bengali-speaking Muslims were murdered. Some in this village in Naugaon district and right here in this field. Ethnic clashes between Assamese-speaking people and Bengali-speaking Muslims led to the massacre. Muslim homes in the neighborhood were gutted, including Marjat Ali's. It is hard to imagine the current ordeal is worse than that massacre.
We're tired of the long hearings, of proving our identity and submitting documents to dismissive authorities again and again. We lost so much money traveling hundreds of kilometers to the hearings.
It is August 31st, the day the final list of the NRC is to be released. Meanwhile, Marjat Ali makes his way to the local NRC office to check his name. Local officials call out his name. They tell him that his family has not made it to the citizens list. I see Marjat Ali's face turn ashen. He implores them to check again. Even though there is a huge line of people behind him, they oblige.
648. 46, 48.
His name is not there. He sighs. No one from his family whose names were under contention has made it to the final list. In dead silence, Marjat Ali walks back home. He never once looks up, sniffling and keeping a distance. I follow him to his home where his family is eagerly waiting to hear about their fate. Marjat Ali does not say a word. Instead, he collapses on his cot, buries his face in his hands and sobs uncontrollably. His family members surround him, but he refuses to speak to anybody. His worst fears have come true. Ali's next step is to present his case before a foreigner's tribunal. If he loses this case, he will be sent to a detention center and finally deported. But nobody knows where he'd be deported to. Ali will likely end up stateless or with his rights severely slashed. For The World, Soumya Shankar, Assam, India.
Soumya is a global reporting fellow with the Ground Truth podcast, 7-part series, Democracy Undone. And looking ahead to our Christmas Eve show tomorrow, he wears a red zoot suit, a big fedora, and delivers toys in his 1972 Cadillac Eldorado. You know who I'm talking about. Yes, Pancho Claus, the creation of a man in Houston who dreamed him up some 40 years ago.
I patterned the whole story on the night before Christmas, but Chicano style. Like, there's no chimneys in the second ward here, so he bust in through the bathroom window.
Okay, that's a little different. Now Pancho Claus does his thing, tossing toys to a couple of thousand kids in Houston's convention center. Over the years, he's become a beloved fixture.
In the community I grew up in right there in Southeast Houston, he was it. When you saw Pancho Claus coming, everybody was excited. He brings that cultural aspect because he does represent our community and he does give back to so many community causes within the neighborhood.
Houston's Pancho Claus, that's next time here on The World. News headlines are just around the corner. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. We return to Antarctica on a ship of researchers looking at melting ice sheets and climate change.
All geared up, we head back outside into the wind on the pier. It's high summer here, but the gusts give us a taste of what to expect as we head farther south.
That's still ahead here on The World. North Korea has been making some vague but worrying threats, saying that the U.S. should expect a Christmas gift from North Korea. What that means exactly is unclear. On Friday, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said he hoped for a diplomatic solution, but that the U.S. military would be ready for anything.
I have two functions here, as I've said before. One is to ensure that we are in a high state of readiness, prepared for to fight and win tonight, if need be, and I'm confident in that. And secondly, to enable our diplomats.
Jenny Town has been following all of this closely. She's managing editor of the website 38 North, where she analyzes North Korea's nuclear capabilities by examining satellite images of key sites.
It would not be out of character for North Korea to do this. They've hinted at it. They've sort of vaguely threatened it. So if they did it, it should not come as a shock. If they didn't do anything, I think it would be more surprising than if they did something. But the question is what the something is really unclear and could be a whole range of things.
So what are you seeing in some of these key locations right now?
At the nuclear research facility, certainly there's some level of activity. It's not heavy activity, but certainly work continues at that site. At the Sohae Satellite Launching Station, which is where a lot of activity has been happening in the recent weeks, we have seen in the satellite imagery signs at the engine test stand that it has been used. There's been speculation that maybe they might do a satellite launch as part of this Christmas gift that they've threatened. But so far, we do not see any signs of satellite launch preparation at the Sohae facility.
So let me just get you to clarify this idea of this Christmas gift from Kim. You're not seeing anything that supports the idea that that event could be a missile launch or a nuclear test?
We are not seeing anything that would indicate a nuclear test or a satellite launch. And a satellite launch is different than a ballistic missile launch.
How can you tell from satellite images?
So, for instance, at Sohae Satellite Launching Station, the main launch pad there is where they would launch satellites from. It's easy to watch, it's easy to monitor, and it's easy, and, you know, we can look for signs that activity is happening. It's much harder to try and anticipate where to look for signs if they were going to do a ballistic missile launch. And that's part of how North Korea's capabilities have evolved over the years, is that there's been a real focus on mobile missile technologies, which don't require a fixed launch pad, and solid fuel technologies, which make it easier for mobile missiles to move around. So, you know, it's hard to anticipate what they're going to do. The signs and the signals coming out of Pyongyang that a long-range missile test is the more likely candidate for this Christmas gift. But certainly, you know, they're not going to show all their cards, and we're not going to know until it happens. And it's highly possible, too, that nothing happens.
Jenny, can you compare what you're seeing now at those facilities in North Korea compared to what they looked like before the summits between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump? I mean, is there essentially no change?
Well, the biggest change is at the Sohae Satellite Launching Station. As part of the negotiation process, North Korea had committed to dismantling the engine test stand there and the launch pad. After Singapore, the dismantlement activities began, and the engine test stand especially was almost fully taken down. All that was left was the superstructure of the actual test stand itself. And then what we saw after Hanoi was that they started rebuilding these structures. Mm. And almost immediately after Hanoi, this work began, and it was done very quickly to fully rebuild the engine test stand and rebuild the facilities on the launch pad.
So from the images that you've seen, are there kind of larger conclusions that you can draw about the state of the North Korean nuclear program?
I think there's always misconceptions that because we were in negotiations, North Korea was just going to stop and wait and see what happens. You know, this never happens. Whenever you're in any kind of arms control negotiations, until the actual agreement is signed, you know, the states continue to develop their capabilities. What we've seen with North Korea is the same thing. So as the negotiations have been going on, there's still been activity at these different sites. So these are all concerning signs and really reiterate why we need to be in negotiations and need to be trying to work towards a deal to freeze programs and then start to roll back.
Jenny Town, the managing editor of 38 North, a think tank that studies North Korea. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
2019 was a big year for scientific discoveries. We had the first ever photo of a black hole, also bones from a new species of ancient human, and now new finds in the plant world. At the Royal Botanic Gardens in the Kew District of London, there were well over 100 new plants and fungi discovered this year. One of the senior botanists there, Martin Cheek, spoke with us about what he thought was one of the most significant.
Although I'm a botanist specializing in Africa, I got really excited by the fungus from China, which is not just a new species, but a new genus. And on top of that, these hypercrelins, which this species contain, have got high levels of activity against tumors. They're antifungal, antiviral. So that makes them very interesting.
So the good news is that some of these new discoveries in the plant world have practical applications. But the bad news, as Cheek explains, just about all these species are facing the threat of extinction.
Mostly climate change is a serious threat to many plant species, especially those at the tops of mountains. But much more immediately is development pressure from us human beings clearing natural habitat in which these species depend for development projects such as hydroelectric dams, or mining projects, or local communities clearing natural habitat for more agricultural land.
Cheek says it's not unheard of for newly discovered plant species to be found in one single location, like a river, a waterfall, or some other specific spot on the globe. And that's why it's so critical for conservationists to work with local governments to protect them.
Sadly, so many species are brought to the edge of extinction and they're made extinct in ignorance, really. People just have no idea that a patch of natural habitat, which is going to be converted to a housing block or to a new field, might have a species that survived nowhere else on the planet.
While those battles are being fought, says Martin Cheek, scientists will continue to make new discoveries.
There are many areas of the planet where no botanist has ever been, no one's been to study the plants, and it does seem really incredible here in the 21st century that there are huge rainforest canopy trees, which are completely unknown. Some of these trees can weigh tons. It's quite shocking that we know so little about what plant and fungi species we have on the planet.
Martin Cheek there, a senior botanist at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, just outside London. The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, spent a lot of time this year reporting on another place that's not well understood. Antarctica, specifically the melting ice sheets there that are pushing up sea levels all around the globe. Carolyn joined a group of scientists on a two-month journey south to Antarctica earlier in the year. That team was trying to discover just how much melting in that region could impact global coastlines. All week, we'll be revisiting Carolyn's trip because, well, it's a sharp reminder of what's at stake for us all with climate change. First of all, Carolyn, we wanted an update on just what we've learned about Antarctica and sea level rise over the past year. Like, what stands out to you as the biggest headlines of 2019?
Marco, it's not one particular study or data point. It's how scientists are talking about the oceans, sea level rise, and what we call the cryosphere, all the frozen stuff on our Earth. So the UN has the science panel, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They release these gold standard scientific reports about climate change, but they're a consensus-driven body. They're considered pretty conservative. This year, they released a report on the oceans, and let me just read to you a couple of things they said. The blue planet is in serious danger right now, and it's our fault. We're causing unprecedented changes to Earth, and that a rapid transformation is necessary. So you can hear that scientists no longer see their role just as doing the science, but really issuing a clarion call and urging policymakers to do something about it.
Right. So the language is more dire beyond how scientists are framing the message about melting ice and changes to the ocean. What else was new this year?
So that same report that was released in September revised the upper estimate for sea level rise by the end of the century up a bit. So in a previous report released just a couple of years ago, it was at 1 meter, a little over 3 feet. This report bumped that up to 1.1 meters. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's mostly coming from melting in Antarctica, and it just shows you how fast things are changing down there. But it's going to be another couple of years before the scientists working on the project that I was reporting on are able to put their findings into computer models to get better projections of whether the West Antarctic ice sheet might collapse, and if so, when.
So you had that extraordinary trip earlier in 2019 with scientists on this icebreaker to Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. Do we know how the glacier has fared in the past 10, 12 months?
Right. So Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica, it's melting fast, and if it becomes destabilized, it could trigger eventually something like 11 feet of sea level rise. So that's why we were going there. And since I sailed across the front of it, since I left Thwaites, it's mostly been frozen in. So Thwaites Glacier runs into the sea, and the sea around it freezes up.
Right. Their winter is our summer.
Exactly. So it's mostly been frozen in one long Antarctic night. Things don't really start moving until more like January, February. So this upcoming year is when scientists will be able to see if some of the changes that we saw are more systemic, longer-term changes, or might just be year-year variation. But there is one new data point on the health of West Antarctica that was published this year, and the rate of melting has about tripled since just 2007. So another piece of evidence that melting there is only increasing.
Yeah, so some kind of grim news. Your reporting last winter, Carolyn, showed just how hard it is to even get to Antarctica, let alone do research there. And you sent back these great dispatches for the whole 2 months you were on the icebreaker, really getting into the science.
Yeah, and also just day-to-day life, what it was like on this ship.
So let's go back and listen to your first dispatch now. You filed this at the end of January, and it begins on the ship you boarded, but still in port in Punta Arenas, Chile.
Punta Arenas sits at the southern tip of South America, on the Strait of Magellan. It's a jumping-off point for iconic hikes in Patagonia, but I'm not here for the scenery. I'm here to ship out. My first stop's a warehouse where U.S. scientists and journalists pick up their cold weather gear. Inside, there's a room stacked floor to ceiling with red windbreakers, insulated overalls, and steel-toed rubber boots. Hi. Beeler?
Ah, Beeler. Caroline.
We grab our gear at the counter.
Thank you. Can I get Carhartts and a dry bag as well?
Sure.
And head to group dressing rooms to try everything on.
Here's my coat. Okay, the coat is gigantic.
The clothes only come in men's sizes, so for women, there's some trial and error in getting the right fit. I traded the coat for a smaller one and moved on to a pair of insulated Carhartts.
Big mittens. Some really cozy fleece sweatpants I'm pretty stoked about. Goggles. Okay, some waterproof waders now. And rubber gloves that are lined. A fleece neck warmer.
All geared up, we head back outside into the wind on the pier. It's high summer here, but the gusts give us a taste of what to expect as we head farther south. Our ship's at the end of the pier. It's called the Nathaniel B. Palmer, and it's chartered by the National Science Foundation. It's the length of a football field, has a huge red hull, and dwarfs even the cruise ship opposite it. I head up the gangplank and onto the deck. Just walked on the ship. My new home for 8 weeks. Look at my room assignment. After settling in, it's time for safety training and a trip into a torpedo-like lifeboat suspended from the side of the third deck.
Okay, let me get you guys' attention real quick, and that way we can get out of here.
Chief Mate Rick Wimkin shows us how to basically lash ourselves to the hull of the boat with chest and waist straps.
Now, the reason why we want to get all strapped in like this is obviously the reason we're abandoning ship is because it's bloody rough out there, so you want to be strapped in, and you won't get tossed around inside the boat. So.
Finally, as the evening sun starts to glare off the water, huge winches haul up the ropes, and the ship slips away from the dock. Near me at the stern of the ship, geologist Becky Manzoni from the University of Alabama is trying to FaceTime her husband and three young kids before cell service disappears. She tells me it was tough saying goodbye.
It was really hard, yeah. Yeah, so they dropped me off at the airport in Birmingham. And, yeah, they were holding on to me, and my 7-year-old was begging me not to go, so.
There's a pretty good distraction for homesick scientists off the front of the ship. We spot whale spouts in every direction.
It's good we're here now. It's very real, isn't it?
Chief Scientist Rob Larder of the British Antarctic Survey is glad to depart after months of preparations, but...
Not relieved yet. I think I'll be more relieved when we've actually got some effective work happening.
Larder's caution turns out to be warranted. Near our original berth, we stop again to fuel up, and the crew discovers an issue with the rudder, which means we could be stuck here a while as they fix it. Delays like this one are common, but Larder says it's eating up the buffer days he and his team have built into the crew's schedule.
If we start losing more time to weather or having to work through ice to get to the areas we really want to be in, then, yeah, it's going to cut into the science time.
Ever since I signed up for this expedition, everyone told me nothing goes exactly according to plan when you're headed to Antarctica. And so we wait. For the world, Carolyn Beeler, still in Punta Arenas, Chile.
Carolyn's ship eventually got moving. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear the next chapter of her journey. When that ship battled 20-foot swells as it steamed south toward Antarctica, you can read all of Carolyn's reporting and see her photos online at theworld.org. The railway portion of the longest bridge in Europe opened today, a cost of more than $3.5 billion, a span of almost 12 miles. Quite the feat of engineering. But as far as many European leaders are concerned, it's nothing to celebrate. That's because of where the bridge was built and who built it. That is Russian President Vladimir Putin. He took part in today's inauguration ceremony for the railway bridge that connects Russia to Russian annexed Crimea. Putin said the bridge would naturally help the economies of both Russia and Crimea, But Ukraine, along with much of Europe, opposed the bridge project. Alexei Starodubov is the director of the Crimean Expert Center in Ukraine. He's a former advisor on foreign investment projects for the Crimean government before the territory was annexed by the Kremlin. Alexei followed the development of the bridge since it was first proposed.
Yes, I used to work with this project when we had this project as a common one before annexation. So it used to be Ukrainian and Russian. It's a big infrastructure project for Russia and for Crimea, of course. However, so I would like to pay your attention that this project is primarily image project. So, and I'm not really sure that this bridge will influence positively on economic development of Crimea.
You say image, but Vladimir Putin says this new bridge will be able to carry all those passengers, 14 million, in fact, with the rail, and 13 million tons of freight next year. So won't it naturally boost both Russia and Crimea, as Putin claims?
I'm not really sure that it's true, so because I'm familiar with the situation in Crimea and I know very well economic situation in Crimea. So in comparison with 2013, so the gross regional product, the structure of gross regional product was destroyed. And we don't have traditional spheres of economics right now in Crimea, like industry, agricultural sector, or like financial sector. We don't have investments right now there. So, and all these issues happened because of European Union as well as United States sanctions regime. And as of now, we have black hole in terms of investments, in terms of export in Crimea. So, and just to say that it would influence significantly, I mean, the construction of this bridge, it will influence on the economic situation. I'm not really sure.
As you say, though, I mean, it's not a cheap project. It costs well over $3 billion. Why would Russia go ahead with this bridge if it were not an investment economically? And if it is about image, what is the image Putin wants to create here?
They have to show to all over the world that they could construct such project. It's just explanation that they have close ties with Crimea, so that this is some kind of communication line between the rest part of Russia as well as occupied peninsula. I think there is no sense to analyze economic consequences related to this project. But totally agree that this is a brutal violation of international law and nothing more as only image project. That's it.
If one of your main concerns, Alexei, is the violations of international law that this rail and bridge present, what do you think the U.S. should do? Do you think Washington will provide assistance and will they also bring in sanctions?
I think they could and they have to do this because you're absolutely right. So you mentioned about violation of international law. And if you're talking about violation of international law in occupied Crimea, so next time it would be somewhere else in the world. So that's why so we have to pay attention to such violations and we have to explain to Russia that we are living in the international law sphere. So and we have United Nations and we have particular rules and they have to follow these rules. So that's why I think sanctions will be very, very influential instrument which could be used and should use by United States as well as European Union.
Alexei Starodubov, the director of the Crimean Expert Center in Ukraine, talking to us about the new rail line connecting Moscow to Russian annexed Crimea. Alexei, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
A few days ago in England, 6-year-old Florence Whittacombe sat down to write some Christmas cards to her friends. Her parents had bought a box of holiday cards from the supermarket chain Tesco.
We were writing in them, and about on my 6th or 8th card, there was somebody already written in it, had already written in it.
And the message did not look like the kind of thing Santa would say, so she asked her daddy for help with the big words. The message said, "We are foreign prisoners in Shanghai Qingpu prison, China, forced to work against our will." It also urged the finder to contact someone named Peter Humphrey. Florence's father, Ben Whittacombe, picks up the story.
It's, of course, not what you expect. And so the first thought was it must be some sort of prank. But on reflection, we realised that it was actually potentially quite a serious thing. And so I felt very shocked, but I also felt a responsibility to pass it on to Peter Humphreys, as the author asked me to do.
Peter Humphrey worked as a corporate fraud investigator in China until he ran into trouble with the authorities and ended up being jailed in that same prison for 2 years. Florence's father found Peter Humphrey through social media and passed a card on to him. Humphrey then contacted the supermarket chain Tesco, which says it has suspended its links to the Chinese factory that supplied the cards. Humphrey says he was not shocked about the message and even thinks he knows who wrote it.
When I was there in Qingpu Prison Foreign Prisoners Block, work was not mandatory. It was not forced. What has happened since then is that there's been a crackdown making it hard for prisoners to survive without working. This means things like blocking funds sent from family members to enable a prisoner to buy his daily necessities like toothpaste and soap and dried noodles and things like that.
China has denied forcing prisoners to work. Gong Shuang, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, today accused Peter Humphrey of making up the story.
This is a farce created by Mr. Humphrey. He can't keep quiet now, and every once in a while he'll come out to hype something up so that people won't forget about him. I'll offer him a piece of advice. If he wants attention, at least make up something new. Here, I can responsibly say Shanghai's Qingpu prison has no such foreign prisoners undergoing forced labor.
If there are any takeaways in the story, Peter Humphrey says it's a reminder of the risk of doing business with China, where Western standards of due diligence can be very hard to uphold. Just enough time for a musical holiday treat, another selection from our list of top 10 favorite albums from 2019. You can find the full list at theworld.org. Making the cut is the album Aban from the Garifuna Collective from Belize. This is the Garifuna Collective's first release since their tribute album to the late great Garifuna singer Andy Palacio. Andy was the best-known music ambassador for Garifuna culture. Clearly, the Garifuna Collective keeps the flag flying on this terrific 2019 release, Aban. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.